So last night the Israeli military continued its assault on Bethlehem. It destroyed three houses. One, Ibrahim Abiyat, who was in the Church of Nativity and was put on the most wanted list by Israel and has been exiled now to Europe and with no real hope of returning to Palestine. And they destroyed two other houses, and they were expecting the Israelis to continue house demolition. They took the Amnesty International Prisoner of Conscience of the Year two nights ago now, at 4 o'clock in the morning, and held his family at gunpoint for 2 hours. And even though they made it explicitly clear that he was not wanted, they arrested him anyway. He's already spent 5 years, I think, in administrative detention, which is the permanent holding pattern that the Israelis will do. They'll put someone in for 6 months for interrogation. And then at the end of 6 months, they'll renew it and keep them in for another 6 months of interrogation, and on and on and on. And it's very common practice, and usually the people stay in prison without any charge or some made-up charge, whatever it might be. They do whatever they want. The tactics that the Israelis use during interrogations are various forms of really hideous torture, and I've been told about a lot of the things that they do, such as making someone stand on their toes because their hands are put in handcuffs, and they have to hold them up really high on a wall and hooked up, and so the only way to stand is just on their tiptoes, and or there's little like small children's school chairs that people are made to sit in while they're bent over and handcuffed to the chairs, and their legs are bound underneath. So just some of the things I've been told about, and various kinds of sexual assaults on the people as well, and but a lot of people won't really talk about what kind of torture they suffer in when they're in interrogation. I think they just don't want to think about it anymore, and there's a lot of shame that goes on, goes around what's happened to them inside. And so there are many things that I don't know about what happened, but have some idea about. And now many of people, when they get out, because most people I know spent at least 5 years in the prison, and they all have various forms of injuries in their bodies that are permanent. Most people have pretty severe back problems, can't sit for long periods of time, can't stand that well or walk very far, and some can't use stairs. And there are several people that have bullets lodged in their bodies, which seriously impedes the ability to move or think or do anything because they're in pain all the time. And it's just common stuff that happens. So anyway, just now the an Israeli jeep came into the camp then, and now it's Ida camp, and it came into the in front of the cultural center here and parked itself for whatever reason, you know, just to frighten the people and to make its presence known. But the residents of the camp responded by throwing stones at the jeep, and it threw sound bombs at everyone and then left. So, you know, that was kind of ironically, but a nice moment in all of this. You see the people feeling the energy to resist in any kind of way. It's heartening because so many people have given up now. Yasmin is suffering another kind of similar to what happened in April. Another severe attack, and people aren't paying so much attention, although now because someone who worked in UNRWA was shot yesterday, they're paying a bit more attention, as well as an international person being shot yesterday. But scores of Palestinians have been shot and killed in Jenin, and there have been many, many arrests. In Bethlehem, the police were arrested. The Israelis somehow think that that Palestinians aren't allowed to have police force, so they arrested all the police that they could find, and also arrested about 30 or 40 Palestinians besides the police, and I've heard that CNN and BBC are both reporting that the people that have been taken by the Israelis are Hamas or Jihad and wanted, and which is not true. You know, many of the people were not wanted that they knew of, or many also have no connection to Hamas or Jihad Islami, and it's just a you know, something that the Israelis tell the international community to try to hide the fact that they are just, in fact, you know, militarily occupying a town that they have no business being in, even under the hideous Oslo agreement, they have no business being inside of Area A. And so they're just demanding people up. They're not doing house-to-house searches right now. They're going more specifically to places, people that they want to, that they decided they want to grab. And they're also going after the family members of anyone who they consider to be wanted. So they're demolishing family members' houses and arresting fathers and brothers of people who they say are wanted. And this, of course, is called punishment, which, of course, is illegal under international law. And right now, especially, just especially sickening, considering that Bush is running around suddenly talking about international law as if he's ever had any inkling that he should be following it, because of the situation in Iraq, and talking about upholding the UN resolution so that Iraq will comply with weapons inspections, which it did in the past as well. The weapons inspectors left Iraq not because of lack of cooperation on the part of Iraq in the past, but because the United States told them to leave because they were going to bomb. So, anyway, of course, Israel is second only to the U.S. In not following UN resolutions and in flouting international law. So we're seeing that again in Bethlehem. And it's, you know, unfortunately, the same old story here, as it is in the rest of the West Bank, and Gaza. Nablus is still under curfew. The people are still being attacked and killed. And even if, you know, the Israeli military pulled out of the cities in the way of taking their tanks out and ceasing to shoot the people, or arrest them as intensely as they are right now, it still doesn't end the occupation of Palestine. And this is something that is a slow death for Palestinians, the occupation deprives them of their freedom of movement, some inability to be able to plan for any sort of future. Under the during invasions, the schools are shut down, of course, and no one can work anything. But under the regular occupation, people still can't often pass through checkpoints that Israel set up inside of West Bank towns and in between West Bank towns, and of course in Gaza as well. And so people can't feel that they can actually make it to work or make it to their school or be able to visit family members or live their lives in any kind of way. And now, I mean, there is a gasification of the West Bank going on, and so the Israelis build a wall for their trapping the Palestinians that live in the West Bank and turning it more into a prison. Really, the feeling of not being able to move or not being able to leave your house for fear of being shot, or if you can leave your house, not being able to leave your town. It's really a way to kill the spirit and the ability to resist, or to mount any sort of viable political resistance. We've seen this over and over. And of course, in the Gaza Strip, the situation is more severe in that the occupation is so completely ingrained in everyday life there that people don't even notice. I mean, there's very little press attention paid to Gaza, to all of the Gaza Strip. And, you know, in the south, in Russia, Israelis are building a so-called security wall. And in order to do so, they've demolished 300 houses in one area, a deeply impoverished area where unemployment is already 80%,
and at least 60% of the inhabitants live under the poverty level, and 30% of the children at least suffer severe malnourishment. So no one is really able to live any kind of what we would consider to be a reasonable life there, and it's been going on for so long that people have really just given up hope, and most people I talk to don't know if they're going to make it through 5 minutes, let alone be able to plan for next week or 5 years ahead of time. Really, the situation is just devastating, and it continues to be, and it has been, and the longer this goes on, the more people are going to feel like there's nothing they can do to resist, and some people will resist in whatever kinds of ways they can, but then the Israelis will use that as a pretext to continue doing what they were already doing. And, you know, last night as I was hearing the bombs going off and the tanks shelling around the camp and around the town of Bethlehem, got the feeling of really, what do they want? You know, and I said that to my friend, what do they want? The feeling of collective desperation on the part of the people here, like, why don't they just leave? And, you know, why don't the Israelis leave? And what do they want? And my friend said they want everything. And that's just the truth. I mean, we know that's part of the Zionist, sorry to say this, but the Zionist plan for what is supposed to be the map that was drawn in 1894. Anyway, it certainly includes much more of the Middle East than just Palestine, but definitely includes all of Palestine. And this is the way that they're getting rid of all of the Palestinians that live here, all of the native people here, this sometimes rapid and sometimes slow death. And in a lot of ways, they just make the life so difficult that Palestinians want to leave. And many do leave, and many do try to leave. But of course, you know, the immigration law in the United States is just ridiculous as far as giving access to any anyone, almost, particularly who's not white European, but particularly for Palestinians and Arabs at this point. And much of the world is following suit in their succumbing the immigration policy. So there's really, besides the fact that right of return is not being honored and is not going to be honored, as far as, you know, it looks like, if we can base anything on history, current events, recent history, and long-standing history, and right of return is kind of out the window at this point. And there's really nowhere for the people to go anymore. I mean, you know, some do want to get out, and they can't. There's nowhere to go. And others never want to leave because this is their home and their land, and why should they leave? You know, everyone here has a story about what was their village before, what was their town before the Israelis invaded and displaced them in 48 or later, as it continues to happen. I wonder, when Barack was prime minister, that was the highest ratio point of settlement building. And there's been a lot of settlement building activity in the time that was supposedly the time of peace, you know, the time after Oslo until the outbreak of the Second Intifada in 2000. Settlement building went up 70%. You just simply look at a map, you can see what you feel when you're on the ground here, but it's this incursion of illegal Israeli settlements into Palestinian towns and cities, either just moving into them or blocking off Palestinian towns and cities to the point where they're completely surrounded, and there's no way for Palestinians to get in or out of their own towns anymore. And they are also surrounded by the bypass roads, Israeli only, that are used for the often heavily armed Israeli settlers, only not for Palestinians and for the Israeli military to drive on and drive around Palestinian towns and villages so they can just further sucks away that of the Palestinians who remain and try to live their lives. Most people just at this point want to have decades and get through a day. There is very little resistance anymore, and it's a very sad thing to see happening now, but after that point, what can you do? I mean, anytime anyone tries to resist, they're put in prison, and even if they don't try to resist, they're put in prison. You know, I've talked to so many people who spent 5 years in prison, 10 years in prison, but they three don't. And we wonder, you know, when we see the Jeep drive into the camp and park in front of the community center where the children play, and, you know, the kids throw stones at the Jeep, how many of those kids are going to end up in prison because they threw that stone? Right now I'm just stepping out on this balcony, so I'm in full view of the Israeli military that's, you know, pointed at the camp with their tanks, and there's a checkpoint right here also. And for me still, I'm not in danger in the way that the people are here who live in this camp year-round. And I'm just here for a little while, and I'm clearly American. The Israelis know who is who's a foreigner and who's a Palestinian. And they're just deep looking at me as, you know, they're not going to do anything to me because the racist nature of this occupation. There's one house here inside of the camp that's now been occupied by Israeli soldiers for 2 days. It's a three-story house, and there are 10 Israeli soldiers who've taken over the top floor of the house so that they can have better aim to shoot at the people inside of the camp. There's two soldiers that are holding three families hostage all on the bottom floor, and a tank parked outside the door with one soldier inside. And this is what what the military often does inside of the camps. It takes over a house. And I asked about this family, and, you know, did they want to get out? Should I go try to negotiate for their release, at least, with the family outside of the house? And what I was told is that the family would rather be held hostage inside of the house than have the military just be in their house alone. Because they think somehow that the Israelis will not destroy their house if they stay inside of it, in the way that they have destroyed houses in the past, for instance, in Jenin last year. I saw many of the houses that the Israeli military had taken over and occupied during the invasion in Netzkar and Jenin camp, and they completely destroyed the inside of the houses and all of the belongings of people. People are already, you know, poor, and their access to be able to buy new things, I mean, they don't have any money in the first place, but just to be able to get to a store is pretty impossible because they're closed so often, because deliveries can't come in. And so when people have, you know, they have a few belongings for their family, they need to keep them. So at this point, the family inside of this camp is, you know, that it would rather be held hostage than lose all of their belongings and their home. I mean, this kind of a state is this. There's no way for them to build another house if they lose this one. You know, if the Israeli military destroys this house, they have nowhere to go. Take the situation in Rafah in the south of the Gaza Strip right now, and to build this 8 meter high and 10 meter deep so-called security wall. You know, when I mentioned the Israelis have destroyed 300 houses in order to do this and shot scores of people, including three-year-old kids eating Ramadan breakfast. I mean, this stuff you think is fiction, the kinds of things the Israeli military is doing and getting away with. But the residents of this camp whose houses have been destroyed, the ones who are still alive are now living in these tents. You really have nowhere else to go. There's no land. I mean, the Palestinian land is already being squeezed out by settlements and by Israeli military outposts. And so the Palestinians that lost their houses are living in these not even tents. They're supposed to be tents, but they are white seats, and they don't go all the way to the ground. And they're just kind of like a little cover, but not really. You know, there's nothing inside, because when the military is destroying the house, the Palestinians are not allowed to bring any of their belongings out with them. We don't have blankets. We don't have mats to sleep on. We don't have, you know, their books or their photographs or anything. And we just sit in the dirt under these white sheets. And this is it now. This is what's left for them. And there's no money. No ability to make any. And so, in order to prevent something like that from happening, I think that the people inside of this camp, in this one particular house, are just hoping to stay in their house as long as possible, thinking that somehow they can save it. And hoping that somehow the Israeli military will finish its, invasion and leave, and they'll be able to get on with what they've got going of a life at this point. And I'm sorry to, present such a hopeless situation, but this is totally out of hand here, what's going on, and that somehow in the international press and in much of the international community, and of course in the United States, this situation is being presented as if the kid in the refugee camp is an Israeli and the tank that's shooting at it is a Palestinian. I mean, beyond that, there's no way, if you're really sitting in this situation, really seeing it, to think that there are two equal sides having some sort of war. It's not a war. But that's why, if there's a suicide bombing, it's, besides that the international community cares about the loss of Israeli life and not about the loss of Palestinian life, also gets played up so much in the media because it's a way of trying to suggest that the Palestinians are actually a warring army that are fighting the Israeli army, and it's just not the case. I mean, Palestinians really in general don't have weapons. They've got almost nothing. I mean, you see they resist with their body. What kind of a desperate situation would you be in if that's all you had left to resist with? Besides the fact that just, you know, the ratio of suicide bombings to the amount of Israeli soldiers running around with two shotguns and a tank that fires missiles and shells and with regular bullets, you know, I mean, there's no way to suggest that the situation is in any way equal. Besides the fact that what's being taken from the Palestinians is their own land. You know, the Israelis have no business being here whatsoever. And even under international law, they have no business being here. That's the ironic thing. And I know many people don't have any respect for international law, but in thinking that it doesn't go far enough in protecting the rights of the oppressed. But in this situation, I mean, it's not even slightly being followed. And really, in the end, you see the people trying to get through a day now, after last night when no one slept. People were waiting to be arrested. They were waiting for their houses to be demolished. They were listening to the sound of the bombs and the tanks shelling and the missiles. And then, you know, the sun comes up. And the ones who still have houses standing, who aren't arrested and aren't dead, try to get through another day.
What an international relief agencies been able to do or willing to do?
International relief agencies?
Yeah.
Well, I'll give you a few examples. I was talking about Rafah and the situation there with the people in the tents. The tents came from an international relief agency. They came from the UNRWA, which is, well, it's UN Palestinian. The UN Just for Palestine. Anyway, a man was telling me about this relief that he was given, which was the tent. And I asked him, you know, do you think maybe the UN should have stepped in before your house was demolished, not just bringing your tent afterwards. And he said, well, you know, they don't really do that kind of thing. They just give a little relief afterwards. That's all they do. And in Mawasi, to get into Mawasi, which is an area that no one can get into unless they're officially a resident of Mawasi and they have a pass card, you know, apartheid pass card that says that they can go through this checkpoint, which is still sometimes closed for 20 days, 30 days at a time. The truck, I mean, I saw a UN truck give up, sat outside to bring in a food delivery. UN would provide basic things like flour and rice and cooking oil to refugees. And it just gave up and turned around and left because it wasn't, you know, I mean, how many weeks can it sit there and wait to get in? Other relief agencies don't come here that much, and when they do, you know, I mean, they came to training in April, but now the same thing is happening again, and really, like, what is relief? I have to say, you know, I don't think that the answer here is to bring relief. Answer is to end occupation. Just because, you know, it's like, you know, killing half your family members and then, you know, getting some blankets afterwards, you know what I mean? The Israelis should be prevented from killing your family in the first place. You know, you don't really need the blankets afterwards. Maybe you do, but you know what I mean. I mean, it's just, what are you doing here? Bringing relief. Relief is not what the people need here. What people need is concerted effort to force the Israelis to end the occupation. And until that happens, there's really going to be, you know, no sort of justice here. And the idea of relief in this sort of situation, it's just almost embarrassing. It's like to bring, you know, a family whose house is half gone, you know, a bag of food. It's like, to what purpose? You know, why are you bringing them half a bag of food? You know, why don't you prevent the Israelis from demolishing their house in the first place? Why don't you make the Israelis leave their checkpoint, take and dismantle the checkpoint so that Palestinians can get to work? And it's not that an inability on the part of Palestinians to have an infrastructure and have a workforce and participate in a global economy, which actually I know sounds strange for me to say, but many people are actually, you know, wanting to do that here. At least to have some chance of living their lives in a way that gives any semblance of normalcy so that they can make any kind of plans for their children. You know, relief is not what's necessary for that. We need to end the occupation, and that's the only way that this situation is going to get any better.
So have you seen a lot of the kids that you saw, like, during the spring when you were there before?
A lot of the same kids?
Yeah.
Some, yeah.
Is there any difference about, as far as how they are?
Everyone looks worse. That's one thing. People look less healthy. They look more worried. They have deeper black circles under their eyes. The kids look more freaked out in their eyes. I mean, that's just what happens, you know, and I'm sure that will be the case when, you know, after a few months, and even, I mean, I've been in the Gaza Strip for the last month, and I'm supposed to come back to Bethlehem now for just to see if I could help out some of my friends here during this invasion, and, you know, even in the last month, the kids look different here than they did before. I mean, how long can you grow up in this environment where you don't know if you're going to live through the day or the night, you can't sleep anymore? There's a high percentage of children now reported who wet their beds at night, who can't sleep at all because they're too afraid. And then in the daytime, their schools are closed, or maybe they're open sometimes. They never know. And there's somebody who's a UNRWA teacher, and he works here in Bethlehem. And of course, last year, school was closed down, but this year, when I was here now 2 months ago, they were very quickly teaching. He said, we expect there's going to be an invasion, and so we're trying to teach everything really fast. So trying to teach a year's worth of school in 2 weeks to a school of kids that missed all of last year. I mean, just what kind of a life is this for these kids? The fact that they can't go and play anywhere. You know, in San Yunis, in Carrara, the kids, regularly in San Yunis, the kids play soccer in an area where they get shot at. They get used as target practice. In Carrara, kids were playing soccer the other day and two were shot. You know, like, there's nowhere for the kids to go. Besides the fact that infrastructure can't be maintained because any time Palestinians build anything, the Israelis tear it down. So just to be able to make a field of grass and keep it sustainable, keep it sustained and as a place for kids to play is almost impossible. And also, you know, that the Israeli settlers, part of the Israeli government's plan when it puts settlements in, is they pick what's the best land, what's the most cultural land, and where's the best water, and all that sort of thing. And so places that have the greatest ability to sustain life have been taken by illegal Israeli settlements. And so the places the Palestinians have of their own land, you know, they have the work of their own land to be able to live on at this point. And I mean, just right now, I'm sorry, you know, but like, there's a tank slowing down. And so the idea that anybody's going to be able to have grass for kids to play in, I mean, it just gets dug up. It just gets ruined, like roads get ruined. They come through with the bulldozer, with a kind of a spike in the front, and just dig through the roads. I mean, it's impossible to just keep anything for anyone to be able to use. And I don't know. I mean, you know what the kids are doing right now? They're standing in the street, in the dust, in the dirt. There's rubble from a demolished house that they're picking up stones out of. That's what the stones are, by the way. Demolished houses, like it's the rubble from the demolished houses that they throw at the tank. You know, that the Israeli bulldozers demolished their homes. So they pick up bits and pieces of their own homes and throw them at the tanks that are coming in to shoot at them. And anyway, so this is what the kids are doing today. You know, they can't be in school. There's curfew. None of the schools are open. And I know it's Saturday, but here, you know, there's school on Saturdays, usually. Not usually, but there would be if there were no... If the Israelis would allow the schools to be open, there would be school today. So anyway, this is what the kids are doing. What kind of a life is this? Nothing for them.
And you said there was an UNRWA teacher teaching? That's not usual, is it?
There's UNRWA schools.
Okay.
UNRWA is like the largest employer in Gaza, actually, and it's UN, the Legion Works Agency, for refugees.
Oh,
but all the employees are Palestinians. The employees are Palestinian. And there are UNRWA schools, which are the refugee camp schools, and there are government schools, you know, authority schools. And they're different things, but they're all open to, you know, I mean, the people, everyone goes to one or the other. And it's not unusual at all to be a UNRWA teacher. You're Palestinian, you teach in a UNRWA school, which is, your funding comes from UNRWA, that's all. And it's part of the relief effort.
Are teachers ever targeted for arrest?
Teachers are often targeted for arrest, and Israeli soldiers told me in Nablus that all of the... Everyone from UNRWA was actually a member of Hamas. I mean, it's just ridiculous stuff. Teachers are often targeted for arrest. The guy I was just mentioning has been 10 years in prison, and his father was a principal and a teacher of a school, and I don't remember how long he was in prison, maybe 7 years, and all of his kids have been in prison. And this is just, when you ask a specific about, is, you know, UNRWA teacher targeted for arrest, or is you know, someone else targeted for arrest, seriously, that everyone else is targeted for arrest. Yeah, I know I said it before, but really, all Palestinians are wanted, period. They put them all in prison, almost. You know, I don't know anybody who hasn't been in prison who's a man. A lot of people I know, the first time they were in prison, they were 12.
What's the youngest the child's been arrested, you know?
I don't know the exact number. I know somebody who was arrested and put in prison when he was 10.